and welcome to the Inside Betting Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Trenhale. So, this is episode 9, and I can now say finally that I've got the podcast onto iTunes. So hopefully if you're a user of Apple Podcasts, you'll now be able to find the Inside Betting Podcast on there and be able to subscribe to it. If you are having issues with it, either with sound quality or ability to download or anything else, then do please contact me. I can't guarantee I'll know what to do or how to do it, but I managed in the end to get the podcast onto iTunes by myself without Anchor's help. So hopefully with enough Googling, I'll be able to fix any problem that comes along. And hopefully this will also increase listener numbers in general and also encourage some more people maybe to provide me with some topics or questions, because right now my list is getting quite bare and I've still got two or three things that I want to talk about, but it'll be really helpful if people can provide me with more stuff to discuss. But this week I got a very good question from Christian Bayer, who you may know from the Twitter handle at Betting Is Cool. And he asked me for my opinion on tipsters, and I'll include touts for the American audience. And he asked, so three parts is, what is my general attitude towards tipsters and tipster platforms? Do you have any experience with tipsters? And would you advise investing in a tipster portfolio? And common pitfalls and what metrics to look out for prior to subscribing, and any other thoughts I may have on it. So I wasn't initially tempted really to do something on tipsters. I have to admit it's an area with a lot of strong opinions and people get quite passionate about it, but it's possibly also for that reason that maybe it's worthwhile doing something on it. And it seems that with the opening up of the American market for legalized sports betting, there's become a much more hot topic, because it would appear that large vocal sections of the internet are particularly keen to highlight the dangers and pitfalls of touts, or you might say the US tipster environment. And basically, they're all scum, they're all out to take your money, provide no value, all the rest of it. Now, I will not be able to talk with authority on the US tout market. I have looked at bits and pieces of it over the years, listening to the ESPN gambling podcasts over the years as well. I used to look at certain sites and certain sites that cropped up. Over the years, when I was looking into betting on US sports, I would come across various things. So I will try and touch on that side of the market as well. One thing I will say is that the initial obvious to me observation is that the tout market in America is like the UK tipster environment on steroids. Where you've got, let's say, some of the more fraudulent tipsters in the UK asking you to sign up for £30 a month. You've got US touts asking you for $10,000 platinum packages or $500 for one tip on the NFL this weekend. It really is quite different in that regard from the UK market. And it certainly looks that the marketing is incredibly aggressive. It's very much out there to capture the casual bettor more than maybe the tipster market over here, which is happy more to, come to you or do some low-level advertising or, click-through adverts, that kind of thing. Whereas the tout industry, particularly in Vegas, we're talking YouTube channels, TV coverage, all this kind of stuff. They're just so much more aggressive with their marketing and just so much more in your face. It's hard for me to say, but you know, even the cheapest tout packages, it seems, in the US are fairly expensive. And when I say expensive, I'm thinking just in terms of what the, you know, if I think about what the median salary in the US is, you know, huge discrepancies between different parts of the US, but, you know, often these people are asking for subscriptions that would be, you know, well over 10% or 20% of your disposable income after taxes, depending on which state you live in, of course. And on top of that, then to recoup those costs, you're going to have to bet in a size where it's feasible for you to recoup those costs. So it just seems to become madness as to how anyone can pay for the service and bet in the size necessary to cover the service a lot of the time. And interestingly, the average stake size for a single in the US, by and large, is just that much higher. Speaking to some guys who work at Cantor Gaming and William Hill over there, please try not to boo me. You know, the average stake with Vegas is very distorting, because if you're going on holiday to Las Vegas and you want to have a sports bet on your preferred college team, whatever it may be, you're not going to have $10. You know, so they see lots of $50, $100 bets. Now, £50, £100 bets in the UK, that is a fairly sizable wager. You know, again, if you think of it in relative disposable income per week terms, if you were spending £100, having a £100 bet every single weekend, that is a significant amount of money in the UK wage scheme, as opposed to the more conventional attitude towards betting in the UK for the recreational bettor, which may be, you know, £2 accumulators, this kind of thing. So the US market can afford to be that much more juiced up, possibly pun intended, because it has people with an appetite to stake that much bigger is possibly an element to it. But yeah, so I may come back towards that towards the end of the podcast. But yes, so before I'm going to partially answer Christian's questions as I go through talking about various points about tipsters. And if there's anything that I've particularly left off from his questions at the end, I'll come back to those. So the very first question about tipsters, which I always ask myself and ask others, do you really want to be following a tipster? Now, what I mean when I say this is a huge amount of satisfaction for both odds compilers and bettors is being right. And if someone else has done the getting it right for you, that really does sap the pleasure from the exercise. You know, disregard the financial returns. You know, my most satisfying betting moments have always been when I've solved particularly tricky problems mentally, you know, or solved a very difficult horse race, golf tournament, whatever it may be. And often they can be that much more rewarding even than the ones where I've made more money on the actual bet. Because that's how much pleasure I derive from the challenge of it. So by signing up to a tipster, you are relinquishing that mental challenge aspect in favor of guaranteeing, or at least you hope, guaranteeing a better, more consistent, potentially, return. If you find yourself, like a vast percentage of the population, as a losing gambler, I would always be of the opinion that the first thing you would try to do is educate yourself. There's a lot of written books, believe it or not, still. I know we all do everything on the internet, but books, internet articles, podcasts, you name it, trying to educate gamblers. And I would say that there's enough free information out there to get anyone up to break even, particularly if I have access to recreational bookmakers, where there's huge areas of just general mathematical error within a recreational bookmaker, deliberate mathematical error almost, I would say, to be exploited if you want to. So you can very easily, I think, get up to break even There may be people out there going, oh, well, you know, easy for you to say. But no, I really believe that if you take time out to educate yourself, you should, you know, you can definitely get to break even. And then if you fixate on a particular area or sport and drill into it and understand betting markets better, that's when you can go from being break even to potentially turning a profit all by yourself without having paid a tipster, and hopefully deriving huge satisfaction out of having done it that way. But of course, you know, if you desperately want to get out of the rut of constantly losing bets, I can entirely understand the appeal of getting a tipster. And there is an increasing trend now to sort of bypass Go. And, you know, there'll be people who have not gone through a prolonged period of losing money and then deciding to turn it around. There are people now who will, you know, see an advert online for a way, you know, to get an income from home or a second income or whatever, and it turns out to lead you to, you know, a tipster group site or individual tipster site. And, you know, you'll be encouraged to use that as a way of making money. And so there are a lot of people who seem to be using tipsters without ever having felt the need to resort to them. They may just see it as, you know, they don't necessarily see betting at all as an intellectual exercise or a challenge. They may just see it as a way to make money in the same way that you might collect coupons or exploit, you know, free 2-for-1 meal offers if, you know, you go through little loopholes, these kind of things. The people who come to it maybe by arbitrage or match betting or other things where they don't necessarily have the desire to see betting as an intellectual exercise. They just see it as an alternative way to make money. It's tax-free. And a tipster is a good extra addition to the arsenal. And if that is the case, then yeah, me saying, are you sure you want to do it? It's not gonna sway you either way. But if you find yourself in a position whereby you've lost a lot of money, or even some money over the years, and you now want to become more profitable, I would suggest that at least try to improve your own betting through learning and not through a tipster. Because your journey back to profitability will often be slower, and you know, there'll be some mistakes, there'll be a bit more genteel, I suppose, potentially, than if you open up a tipster and then immediately get highlighted with a load of other people who follow the tipsters by bookmaker, and they shut your account before you've even had a chance to get back to flat at least. And there's something, you know, hugely rewarding to getting back to flat if you've been a loser. And on top of that, the process of getting back to flat will be hugely beneficial to you for any future betting, whether it's to then become more profitable or even to follow tipsters in the future. Because believe it or not, following tipsters, like any form of betting, requires discipline. People seem to think that following a tipster sometimes completely absolves them from having to worry about anything. You know, they'll do the staking for me. It's sort of built-in discipline. I just follow the emails or the, you know, messages or whatever it is when it comes in. And that is not the case. And having, you know, as I say, getting yourself back in the black by yourself, that will instill so many lessons and a lot of discipline that will then stand you in great stead going forward. But it would be a pretty poor podcast on tipping if I was just to say, don't use tipsters. You want to be trying it yourself. So let's get, you know, into more depth. Before you go signing up to any tipsters, if you've already made the decision to take, you know, your own attempt at odds compiling or finding, looking for value bets in the market, if you've already made the decision to go down the tipster route, do ask yourself, why not just become an arbiter? Now, you think that may sound a bit strange, but there is some money to be made from careful and considered arbitrage, not necessarily the amounts that were possible many years ago, that's for certain. There is some money to be made from match betting as well, which of course is essentially arbitrage of another name, really, at the end of the day. Various bonus abuses, free bets, and casino offers, online casino offers, all these things. If you've made the decision to sort of take the challenge out of it, if you like, ask yourself, how much do you expect to be able to win from any given betting account? Now, most people won't know, and the truth is that I can't tell you, because there's such a huge wide range of outcomes where some people seem to have had profitable accounts that have lasted for months and months, even years, and other people seem to have accounts that get closed on the very first bet. There are a whole variety of ways to improve your chances of not having your account closed. I'm not going to talk about those in this particular episode. There's plenty of articles on this subject online and websites that will help with this, including any arbitrage website will generally have a forum. The software providers will have enough forums and people giving advice on how to avoid being restricted or closed by bookmakers. If you do arbitrage and choose to complete the arb, and by that I mean you choose to do the potential sharp bookmaker side as well as the software side, so a large amount of match bets and arbs will be with either exchanges, sharper bookmakers, so maybe in the close to kickoff markets it'll be an Asian handicap bookmaker, or potentially Pinnacle at various times across various sports. You can either close the arb, obviously play all size to reduce your risk to zero, or you can just take the value side, so by just betting the softbook side. I would say that from everything that I have read and understand, when comparing the two strategies long term, you're slightly better off closing the arb. This can mean that you're left having only made, you know, 50 quid from several large stake arbs before getting closed, but generally the absence of risk means that larger staking on smaller sized arbs that maybe aren't necessarily as easy to detect for bookmakers that they are arbs, you reduce your volatility, obviously, if you get as close to zero risk with your arbitrage bets. And generally, over time, I think it's proven to be better. There was a good article on a website called Church of Betting, where I believe they took a large sample of potential arbitrage bets and analyzed which would have been better for you. And psychologically, it's better to reduce variance to as small as possible. If you're psychologically happier, discipline improves just by virtue of that. So if you think to yourself each, you know, given account is going to be worth potentially 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, who knows, depending on how soon you're rumbled, does it matter to you really whether you get it via arbitrage, match betting, bonus abuse, or whether you get it from a tipster? Now, weirdly, there seems to be some kind of, I say weirdly, it's not weird, it's a perfectly normal human reaction, really, is to live vicariously through your tipster. So you want to cheer with them, try not to be sad with them too often if you can avoid it, because you don't want them to be tipping up losers, obviously. But it seems to be more satisfying to people to follow a tipster than to do this via arbitrage. Arbitrage feels very like you're becoming an accountant and your time off. But, you know, I would say that there is a lot of useful skills to be learned about betting from being a long-term arbor, and you'll learn a lot about the efficient, you know, the way markets behave, what moves markets, and a variety of other things, money management, discipline, terms and conditions, rules, settlement rules, all sorts of things that I desperately wish people, particularly people who work in our industry, actually were completely au fait with and new before they are, you know, because there are, I guarantee you there are odds compilers sat on, well, some odds compilers somewhere at desks around around the world who would benefit hugely just from a rather simple ARVAS education. You know, if someone has to ask, does a set need to be played on Betfair for a tennis bet to be paid out or not? You know, the moment you're asking things like this, well, you just don't know enough about the betting markets in general. There's no excuse not to become as, even in areas that you're not necessarily interested in, you know, learn every little element about how they behave and try and, you know, understand why bookmakers do what they do. So, yeah, I would say that the risks with following tipsters, of course, are that you can place the bet at an arbitrage price. So no one at the other end is going to know whether it's an arb or a tipster. They don't care. You've taken a value bet. That's not what they want. You can be caught with a load of other people coming on at the same time. They will, you know, profile that kind of business. Okay, so we get a load of people who come on at 9:15 every day and back, horses in low grade handicaps, whatever it may be. Over time, we've done pretty poorly on this business. Okay, anyone who consistently does this, or not even consistently does this, first time anyone shows up in this herd of people, going to get cut or restricted. Generally, just betting, you know, you've got to ask yourself, what do bookmakers want? And they make it abundantly clear. You know, you just have to look at the way they advertise, where the promotions are. You know, they want you betting on the live. They want you betting on accumulators. So the moment you're not doing those two things, it is a simple, people say like, oh, I'm just having a normal straight up single bet. Well, unfortunately, a normal straight up single bet outside of live is already, you know, a much lower EV bet for bookmakers to take on average. So, you know, from this perspective, being an arber and being a tipster follower can realistically put you in just the same amount of risk of being closed. I think a lot of people think as an arber, you'll get closed instantly. You know, if anything, people who are long-term arbitragers, you know, spend a lot of time opening up new accounts, they will, get as much mileage out of their arb accounts as anyone who follows semi-decent tipsters. In fact, if you follow a tipster and you're not getting closed, to be honest, there's sort of almost a worry there from the beginning. So, yeah. So ask, you know, so again, this is probably not what people who follow tipsters want to hear. Ask yourself, why not just be an arber? It'll stand you in good stead. You'll learn the same amount of discipline as you would following a tipster. And there are other opportunities such as, things like the casino abuse as well, bonus abuse. To sort of add on top of your sports betting. Of course, there may be people who are doing all of that and tipsters just really trying to get as much as they can out of it. And potentially there are people always who are going to be looking for the holy grail for tipster followers, which is a bookmaker that makes money to, a tipster that makes money to closing line prices or at sharp bookmakers or Betfair SP and the like. So they may want to get tipsters that will facilitate that as well as doing all the arbing and other stuff. But yeah, so now we can move on to the core questions regarding any tipster for me. So again, sounds completely naive, I suppose, but are they profitable? Now, every single tipster website is going to show a time frame that is profitable. Now it's interesting to see how long that time frame is and how much they have records for that overall time period. But, you know, there's always going to be a page somewhere, probably with a graph or with just a, if you'd bet £10 or £100 your money, you'd currently be up X pounds. So asking, are they profitable? Well, of course, they're all going to say they're profitable. Is it plausible that they are profitable? This straight up will just come from, this is sort of my initial instinct. So this is just to rule out the preposterous. you know, things that would fall into this would be, you know, someone who maybe suggests, I don't know, their, you know, let's say there was something just called back all favorites in horse races, tipster, you know, there's got to be some basic ask. If you can't, if you don't trust yourself to be able to detect the most fraudulent, you know, our Saturday Premier League ACCA, you know, tipster, you know, it's unlikely, you know, how do I know it's unlikely? Well, you know, what is the probability of finding value on one game in the Premier League on Saturday? It's not that big. What's the probability of finding multiple positive EV legs to an accumulator every Saturday? That's probably less likely still, you know, so you've got to basically just strip up. But that only rules out a small percentage of, you know, tipsters. But you've got to ask yourself, you know, is it just completely implausible? But you also need to look at the proposed returns and the proposed win rate. So let's say that they are a football tipster, and let's say that they predominantly tip in the top five European leagues, and let's say they tip Asian, a mixture of Asian handicaps and three-way prices. So a very simple rule would be, let's say on average, the Asian handicaps you're betting into is 104. If you've got access to, you know, Asian bookmakers, top five leagues, you're going to be betting into tighter than 104. But let's say when you open up an odds comparison site like Odds Portal, which very handily does this calculation for you anyway, if you look at the average odds and the average overround, let's say it's 104. Now, a good, very basic rule of thumb is expected ROI betting on Asian handicaps in that situation would be half of the overround. So I would be looking for someone who has an ROI of around 2% betting into 104 books. Now, people conceptualize overround and margin at bookmakers as protection. So when they see large overrounds, the instinct is it's going to be harder to make money on anything that's bet to a larger, to a higher overround. The reality is more often the case is that providing there are plenty of bookmakers who are pricing up that market or that sport, and they have all congealed around this level of overround, that is their level of, basically implies their level of caution and their level of inaccuracy that is inherent within the market. So if you find a three-way market in a league that's bet generally to 111 versus a league that's bet generally to 108, if people ask me which one would I prefer to bet into, perversely, I will say into the 111 one. Because anywhere where 111, because there's market forces, all the bookmakers competing against each other, which always will keep the overround slightly artificially lower, especially if you have access to all the bookmakers and can take best price, actually keep the overround artificially lower than they would like. And if they feel that 111 is their bite point, that suggests to me that there will be more inaccuracies in that league than there would be in the 108 league. Liquidity reduces overround, liquidity improves pricing efficiency, you know, all these things are intertwined. So let's say horse racing, let's say the average horse race being bet to has an overround of 120, say, or the kind of races that someone was tipping into. Half of 20, 10%, ROI of 10%. It's also dictated, of course, by average odds. So golf is a good, you know, let's say golf is bet to around 150 to 160. If you're betting at sort of the average winner price, which used to be around 40 to 1, maybe a bit shorter nowadays on certain tours, about 40 to 1, I'd be happy to see a golf tipster produce something in that 25 to 30% ROI range, because there's going to be those bigger odds which drive bigger ROIs. And it's possible also that someone within the golf tipping range could be up 40, 50, 60, depending on whether they're looking at just triple figure odds. It's potential that they can have, certainly for periods of time, very high ROIs. But yes, as a very basic rule of thumb, if there are plenty of bookmakers in the market, it's not just one bookmaker betting to, you know, 120 on a three-way. If there's lots of bookmakers in the market pricing up a league, and they feel they can only go as low as, say, 111 as opposed to 106, then that immediately tells me that it's a measure of how random the results are, basically. How much does the bookmaker need to add into their prices to get around how inefficient they are at predicting the closing price, or how efficient the bookmaking market is in general at predicting the outcomes of that given sport. So once you have this very basic rule, horse racing tipster saying 50% ROI doesn't seem likely. Premier League tipster, 10% ROI doesn't seem likely. So you can get that feel of what is realistic or not. And the same goes for win rates. You know, you take an implied, you know, look at an average odds that someone is tipping out. Let's say it's around Pick'em, you know, soccer, 50-50 Asian handicaps. What is the probability of them hitting 80% strike rates, 70% strike rates? There's actually things online which you can do to sort of check these kind of things, do the maths for you. You know, what's the probability that that is achievable? Joseph Bookdahl, on his very good football data, tennis data websites, has a little t-test p-value calculator, which will give you a rough approximation of how likely a given ROI basis the average odds is. In general, that's another good way to do. But yeah, so but the basic, you know, large, you know, that basic half over round principle is not as bad as you think. That's a reasonable way to assess the achievable ROI for a tipping service. I want to see a lot of bets, obviously, although of course conjuring up historical bets, piece of cake. And ideally, I want to see some proof beyond just the P&L as to how superior to the market they are. So if they do some sort of testing of the prices they tip versus where the market closes, whether it be using sort of a bookmaker average or a sharp bookmaker's closing odds like Pinnacle or Betfair SP for horse racing, that's also when I see, are they able to beat that closing line? This is, you know, the equivalent of shots on target to goals. You know, the money you've made is the equivalent of goals. The underlying metric is how much do you beat the closing line, the principle being that the closing line is more efficient than the opening line. So the market walk between one and the other, you know, the greater the distance of that, the more chance you have of beating it. So the more volatile a market is in general between its opening line and closing line. This is something that's worth looking into if ever you get the chance. If you want to know whether a given market is particularly worth getting involved, you want as much volatility between the opening and closing prices as possible. And you want your tipster to tip at a point during that movement when you can capture a lot of the difference between, you know, you want them to provide you with a tipping in a market where you can capture as much of that as possible. I would say that for some tipsters, the closing line value, if you like, is not as relevant as others. This is another episode I possibly would look into, but it is not correct to think that closing lines are particularly predictive as a whole. Closing line invariably, although in certain sports, in certain areas, it can be very marginal, but invariably are more accurate than the opening line. You may think that, well, that's bloody obvious, but I've done research on certain sports, certain areas, where there is barely anything in it. And there is a lot of movement between opening and close, and the close is not necessarily more accurate than the opening line in some places. I'm looking at you, esports. So you would ideally want your tipster very obviously to beat the closing line. I'd still say it's very important. Although, if someone was tipping in a particularly liquid market, debatable how much use that is to most people. But it is conceivable that beating the closing line is not quite as valuable as you might think. You may think to yourself, well, surely I need to beat the closing line in order to make money. But you look at closing lines collectively on average. So you take a whole lot of implied probabilities from closing line and you assess how close they are to predicting what actually happened in reality. And then you can have someone who tips around that average and is the right side at the right time, but overall is makes money, but not necessarily more predictive. Hard to think of an easy way to describe this concept, but so let's say there's a coin. It can be either heads or tails, and, you know, we'll call heads a one and tails a zero. The average over thousands and thousands of coin flips is 0.5. However, it can never be 0.5. Let's assume it can't land on its edge. It can only be one or zero. So the market price is up over time. You know, it may price it up as 10 to 11 a side, let's say. And on average, those odds are accurate. But it's conceivable that someone who will only ever bet heads, so they'll only ever bet one, so their average is always one, but they choose when they bet one, when they bet heads. Now, if they bet heads more often than 50% of the time when it is heads, I'm not explaining this very clearly, but it's what I'm saying is that generally market efficiency is very predictive of the outcome generally, but there's a lot of noise. So over a long period, when people do these studies of how accurate bookmaker odds are, you know, they look at the last 10 years of Premier League odds and say generally the Premier League odds are very good at predicting what actually happens in real life. For starters, when they say very good, they're better than guessing. They're never supremely accurate because there's a tremendous amount of volatility in football, and it's a pretty hard thing to predict, even if you've got the collective wisdom of experts that is the bookmaking community. But on top of that, it can be very unpredictive for huge periods of games. You know, it can be very poor for periods and better for others. If you take a big enough sample, big enough average, everything can look clean and nice. But someone who has the ability to pick individual spots when they want to bet, they're not necessarily competing against that market. You know, if you ask someone to bet every single game of the Premier League, a selection without fail, the market's going to eat them alive. But if they're allowed to bet one game every so often when they feel that there is advantage to do so, the closing line is they may be in that instance, you know, they can bet at the closing line, let's say, and they can still beat it because it is possible to be more efficient than the closing line if being selective and in theory. Unlikely a lot of the time, but in theory. So, yeah, so that's a bit of a garbled section there, but I hope that sort of, so, you know, are they profitable things to look out for there? Is the method sound? I would like any tipster I follow to give me as much as they can without giving the game away. So I want them to give write-ups, give thought processes behind it. Does the thought process make sense? Can they give me a true odds price, or at the very least some target odds not to take it below? Although having said this, people horse racing is particularly hard because coming up with a true price in horse racing is a ridiculously challenging thing to do. And even if you do come up with a rating or a method of compiling true prices for horse racing, I guarantee there'll be so much volatility in your predictions versus the market over time. It's pretty hard to really stand by. I make it 2-1 according to my algorithm. So take anything bigger than that. with horse racing. There are probably people out there shaking their heads saying that they do that perfectly all the time and make lots of money, but I've yet to see much very clean, not like, you know, some of the expected goals models you see, which do a pretty good job of getting a rough idea of what the closing odds are going to finish up at a lot of the time. I see a lot of horse racing modeling algorithms that come up with some quite wacky odds, make money undoubtedly, but the true price is hard to guarantee. So in horse racing, I prefer someone to say target odds, you know, even if it's as simple as I thought this odds would be tens, I logged on this morning, it's available at 20s, seems reasonable to take this down to 16s, whatever. And yeah, from a point of view of, you know, for people who want a bit of advice, I'd always say, you know, if they've got a large enough sample size of bets that you feel are probably reliably real, you can look at their historical ROI and use that to create a target odds. So if on average a horse racing tipster has a 20% ROI, you know, I like to think that it's not unreasonable to hope that they will achieve 50% of that going forward. You invariably first see a tipster when they're on a good run for the first time it comes into your eye line. So let's assume that, you know, they're on an unsustainable run at that point. They're going to get more popular, more people are going to try and bet it. So, you know, half the ROI that they've achieved historically. If you know that they've got a 10%, if you feel like they're going to have a 10% ROI and they tip up something at, you know, any given odds, 10 to 1, 21, whatever, you know that basically if that price moves more than that 10%, if you do that on average over and over again, by your estimation, you're going to lose money. So you set yourself a target odds just by using their historical ROI. That's not perfect science at all, you know, again, in the half of the overround example, you know, but it's a reasonable rule of thumb that, and, you know, again, adapting for some sort of, so, it's, you know, 20% ROI historically, 10% ROI, I'm willing to think is the future ROI. So realistically, if it's shortened by more than, let's say, 4%, giving me the 6% remainder, if you like, if it's shortened by more than 4%, I won't touch it. But anything within that 4% buffer, I'll take it. You know, depending on, you know, where you think your preferred cutoff point is. Do they explain their method in depth? You know what you're betting, why you're betting it, I suppose. You know, do they use time figures if it's horse racing? Do they use an expected goals model? Do they, you know, is it a low-level soccer tipping service? Do they go to the training, you know, camps? Do they watch the games in depth? You know, where is the edge being derived from? People can make incredibly convincing sounding edges, to be honest. So even if they explain their method, it's still quite easy to be convinced by them. But I don't like anything that's too opaque. So, you know, I use my specially devised algorithm using 4,000 inputs to create, you know, it's very easy to say that and tell me nothing, basically. So even if someone is using a mathematical model, I would always prefer them at least to say, you know, what statistics are going into the model. People think they've given away the, you know, the goal, but, you know, at least if someone tells me, oh, I use, you know, shots on target, I can assess, well, you know what, shots on target data has been around for donkey's years now. What's the likelihood of that method still being able to make money in, say, the Premier League? Not so likely. Oh, but he's decided to do it for the Finnish Jokinen, lower level Finnish soccer, and he's done it because he's got a few mates that go around the grounds counting shots. I don't know, whatever. You know, I don't discount things purely on the method alone, but how likely that method is to have been filtered into the market. So you want to be checking for that. And sometimes you'll just see that it's very clearly obvious that they're dependent on just a simple exploitable mathematical error. The most obvious example of this would be if someone was looking for overbroke place books for each way betting. So in horse racing, if they're only ever tipping in eight runner and 16 runner handicaps, you know, slew of horses, that kind of thing, then the chances are that the edge is not derived from their knowledge of horse racing and the horses. It's derived simply from, you know, effectively a loophole in the market, if you will. And that's not to say that that's not a perfectly reasonable way to make money, but you don't need to pay someone else to do that for you. You know, you can have bookmaker's website up, you can have Betfair up, you can have a bad each way race, which again is easy enough to Google what that means, and you can look for when the place part on Betfair goes below the equivalent place part on a horse at the bookmaker, and there you go. Incredibly easy. Don't need to pay a tipster for that. You might save yourself some legwork by paying for a bit of software, not much money to be fair, which basically highlights those situations to you. But, you know, there you go. Are the profits achievable? Things like depth of market, market type, time of release. How many people are subscribed to the tipping service? How many people are you competing with? A lot of people obsess over this, and it is very much something to be concerned by. However, always remember that you have one thing on your side, which is that people are absolutely terrible at staying the course. So any time a tipster goes on a bad run, you're losing competition by the day, by the tip. So it is important for a depth of market. You know, you don't want someone who's got 10,000 subscribers all piling into something, you know, no matter what the market is, really. So you hope for someone to have some restricted level of application for it. And you'd hope that they go for a market type that is at least possible for, you know, a selection of you to get on at any given time. I like, you know, I would like volume. I'm, you know, if someone gives, you know, most bemusing thing ever is to me that, you know, some of these review sites complain about when the tips are sent, or the number of tips in particular. What a load of bollocks. Just send me a million tips in the middle of the night. Because if it's profitable, you know, you set your alarm, you turn the computer on, you place as many of them as you can. If someone is overall positive EV in what they do and profitable, it doesn't really matter if you miss them. If there's lots of them, even better. So it doesn't matter, you know, you'll get on to the next winner faster. But, you know, people obsess over missing out on that one winner. Even if it's, you know, something like a golf tipster service, there's no, you know, guarantees that, you know, it doesn't make it less likely that the next tip in the next tournament is a winner as well. They may hit three winners on the bounce. You know, yes, of course, they could hit one winner and not hit another one for the whole year. And then they may be saying how, well, it's another year just about in front. And the fact is you're, you know, 50 units down. But, you know, if you're thinking in, people think like, you know, don't think in short term, you know, think in the long term. People forget the long term is longer than you ever think. You know, think of your betting lifetime. You know, I laughed because it was Ted Knutson on, I think, the Business of Betting podcast, who talked about once in a lifetime bets, McGregor versus Mayweather. And, you know, how much does one have on a bet? Actually, it was Bet the Process, this podcast anyway. How much does one have a bet on a bet of the lifetime? And he said, well, the fortunate thing is bets of the, you know, betting lifetimes, bets come round, you know, every 5 years. And this sort of amused me because it does highlight that, you know, if the average person has one bet a week, who does it recreationally, maybe two, five, your ambition is to try and cram in a person's lifetime of bets into as short as time as possible. If you can turn it all over in a week, brilliant, so much the better. So that is, you know, in terms of market type, time, you know, market type, the thinner the market, I suppose, the more repeatable opportunities I want. So let's say they tip on, you know, lower league soccer and they release, you know, 20 tips a day. And I, you know, receive the email. I try to get on as many as I can at hopefully better than what the target odds are, either calculated by myself using the historical ROI or by, you know, the target odds provided by the tipster. And providing I observe that target odds, don't place any of the bets that don't meet those criteria, I don't get to, then hopefully, you know, 20 bets every day, you know, we'll get up to 1,000 bets and I'll have hit enough of them. You know, if you've, people I think assume that they'll only ever, you know, every time they miss a bet, the bet they've missed is the one that wins because the market only ever moves the odds of the, you know, the market knows that was a good bet or that was a bad bet. So if that was a bad bet, I'll move the odds and not the others. Don't overthink that. You know, if a tipster's profitable over time, and you know, not only that, but these prices can bounce back out often. So just because you missed it when the email first came out, come back again. But yeah, so are the profits achievable? Well, you know, ideally a deep market. If not a deep market, then lots and lots of bets. And yeah, okay, so time release. You know, I don't necessarily want it in the middle of the night. I'd be happy to, though, if it was very profitable. You know, but is it a time that you can get to your computer easily? In the middle of the night, if anything, it's an opportunity for me to get away from Mrs. T snoring. So probably the best time for me to receive tips. But yeah, you know, obviously getting a load of these while you're at work and then trying to sneak into the gents and place them on your phone and stuff can be a real pain in the ass. And so, yeah, and the other part of our profits achievable is how quickly will I get closed? Is it utterly dependent on recreational bookmakers? If yes, how likely is this particular strategy to survive on a given bookmaking account? You research enough about following tipsters and betting in general, you'll know that the longevity of, you know, a horse racing tipster who's successful is going to be shorter than that of someone who tips on a relatively solid liquid soccer market, say. So, you know, get a feel for, you know, how long you think the account's going to last. Do you think that you have a way to get more accounts if they're closed? You may get, you know, in order to get the best subscription price, you might log in for, you know, 6 months. But after a month, you've got no way of placing those bets, which is very infuriating, obviously. So you have to sort of factor that in. And remember, you know, a closed bookmaking account really is useless. But, you know, if you can still knock around and get those little, you know, accumulator refunds, you know, £25 accumulator refund if one leg goes down, they're a nice little angle. Or if you can still get the, you know, free bet, if you bet on a live game, you know, it's pretty easy. Just look, you know, is the bookmaker's odds roughly in line with Betfair? Yeah, it is. Okay, well, happily place a bet on just anything. Know that it's not negative EV or positive EV. It's just flat. But you get the free bet, so you've made the money, effectively, if you can think of it like that. You know, casino abuse, you know, it completely killing off an account, some really hostile, you know, tips to recommended bets, you know, bloody overnight horse racing and this kind of crap. You know, that is, you know, you've got to ask yourself, do I want to deny myself all the little extras? And the best example of this is undoubtedly Bet365. The Bet365 account is without doubt the best account in the industry. The sheer number of bonuses, promotions, all the little tidbits, you know, they are worth plenty. So, you know, how quickly you'll get closed and sort of the fashion of the bets. You know, if you're successfully betting, say, lower league soccer, you know, maybe a day out or something like that, you may not get given the full, you may be cut to 50%, 10%, who knows, you know, but you may not get the full treatment. But the moment you're completely closed, that really is useless. And in terms of the profits achievable, you can scale your expectation for profits based on, you can just scale your activity, your staking on the profits you want and sort of vice versa. Sorry, as in, what I'm trying to say is achieve the profits that will allow you to go on for the longest. So stake, right? Come on, Matthew, get it together. Overall stake less than you think. So, you don't want to be just putting best bet max on these things. You're thinking to yourself, all right, well, I've got to recoup the cost of these subscriptions. And obviously, I want to make lots of money. So £50 here on this 10 to 1 shot, or whatever. No, a lot of people think in terms of, right, so what's my betting bank? What's the recommended stake? Maybe do some of their own calculations about what stake to use, etc. For me, how many bets are there? If I just bet in fivers and tenners, what can I achieve? Is that level of profit appetizing for the amount of work it is? Because if you bet in fivers and tenners, you can potentially go for a very long time. It then just becomes a question about how many tie opportunities to bet fivers and tenners can you get? You want to be, betting people. You got to think in terms of your overall volume, not in terms of your individual stake size. So, are the profits achievable? Well, ask yourself what profits are achievable with a small staking pattern would be my suggestion. For an example of sort of what can be achieved, the person who in fact asked this question for me originally, Christian Baer, the betting is cool, his implementation of Joseph Buchdahl's Wisdom of the Crowds system to create high volume, lots of bets in small stakes is a good example of how, what you really want to be doing is just getting as many bets on as possible in small stakes. Obviously, that's time consuming. You've got to look at how much your time is worth, but I would say that that is always preferable in terms of, account longevity and being able to maximize the promise, particularly of a given tipster. Right, just going to take a quick break and then I'll finish this off. Only got a few more bits to go. Right, okay, so short break over. So not coming into sort of the final things when following a tipster, are they professional? Just a small thing this. Used to be able to gain a little bit out of the website, as in, just was it, reasonably well put together, that kind of thing. That's out the window now. Some of the websites are just things of absolute beauty now, flash, all sorts going on, graphs, video, the lot. So you can no longer, we're heading almost in a direction whereby the website, if you can spend that much time or money on making a website that beautiful, arguably you can't have much time to hone your tipping skills, I would say. But certainly that was once upon a time something which, just a website that worked just meant that you gave enough of a crap about what you did in order to make it possible for your clients to actually get the service that they were paying for. Things like reliable payment, do they use a payment processing service where there is a recognizable one, recourse if you want a refund, this kind of stuff. And correspondence, they should, even before you've signed up, they should be happy to answer questions, contact them, and they should be good with correspondence once you're actively subscribing to them. These all sort of fall slightly into the which consumer magazine style, nice to haves. Ultimately, if I need to go around someone's house with used fivers, and they basically slip me a piece of paper with the tips under my door each day, and they're rude as you like. All these things could be ignored if they did the business in terms of returns. But yeah, by and large, I do like to see a certain element of order. The idea that you'll see these websites that are almost carbon templates over and over again. My favorite, particularly long scrollers. So you scroll through acres and acres of wordage and graphs and all the rest of it. And every so often there is a bubbly bar in the middle saying start your free trial now, all the rest of it. It's entirely possible that some of these format websites are providing, you know, reliable tips of service. I can't rule anything out, but I automatically think when I see one of those, they're sort of part of a certain stable of tipsters who often are slightly on the lazier end of the spectrum in terms of what they tip. The edges they're finding are very marginal at best, and they're just running several of those websites simultaneously, and just hoping that one of them becomes successful and attracts more business, I suppose. An independent website, you know, is preferable, although more and more tipsters are going on to tipster platforms rather than spending time creating their own website. You know, how professional is a tipster platform? Well, you want to look at the kind of things they're recording, how they record the odds, when they record the odds. Do they record the closing line on your behalf? You know, generally the due diligence you would do on a tipster, even if they weren't on the platform, you've got to do the same thing, but for the platform as a whole. One thing I would say about tipsters, again, can you learn from them? This would dictate, I suppose, so I ought to say on the record that I have signed up for free trials for countless tipsters, hundreds, maybe even over 1,000 in over 17 years. I absolutely love, you know, the cast iron can't be beat system, all of these. In the same way that people might collect, you know, novelties, I love collecting all these crazy, you know, I have a special email address that I subscribe to all these things, and I'm just so fascinated to see what, you know, the snake oil salesmen are doing at the moment, what's the trend of the moment, or, you know, the crazy ideas that people come up with for betting systems. I love it, absolutely love it. Which may seem a bit tragic, really, but there have been instances where I've paid for them, and often I've ended up paying briefly for one, which is in a particular new area that I am investigating betting on myself. So let's say when I first started looking at tennis, I would straight away try and find who was perceived generally online to be the best pre-preview writer or the best paid for tipster out there. And if they had like a 1 month option, I would often subscribe to it. Even if it was just to compare the kind of selections with what kind of selections I was making, you know, even if they had no write-up that I could learn from, you know, what time did they send the tips? What bookmakers were in the market when they did send them? Did the market generally move the way that they had tipped? All these things, you know, I sort of almost considered it a cost of learning or investigation when I took on a new sport. And even now, if there's something that looks particularly interesting, I consider it just sort of a sunk cost of learning more about the betting industry and betting world, you know. And some stuff I've got a pretty good filter. But, you know, I still have paid for the odd thing where I've, you know, received the first correspondence and the first few tips and thought, oh, fuck, that was a terrible waste of money. But that happens. But, yes, generally I've sort of been quite good at resisting that unless I think it's really got some merit in it. But, yes, more often than not, what I've gained from tipsters rather than actual returns is just learning little bits and pieces, little angles from them. And not because necessarily always they've revealed their angles, but just, you know, you track someone's bets, you make a note of all the different elements that you can, you know, are they backing the same players or horses regularly, certain types, do they always tip in the same type of race or the same league or the same market, are they always going under or over, all these elements you analyze. And it's great if they've got a long, you know, back catalog of tips that you can download. You have to hope they haven't been doctors, you know, download and you can look for patterns there. But it's amazing how quite often tipsters will find a bizarre little inefficiency in the market that hasn't been ironed out. And there's a whole load of noise So, you know, 20% of their bets are just random losers that they don't realize. But it just so happens that 80% of their bets are on, you know, under total bookings in the championship or whatever. It's just a completely random one. And it just so happens that maybe they've been over, you know, they've been bought up for the last, you know, 5 years. And so they've been a bit too high. And all they've done is basically they found, it seems, an edge, but they've called themselves, you know, the booking master or something like that. And they've set up a football bookings tipster website, you know, and that's the result. But it turns out that all that's happened is there's a edge potentially, which, you know, will evaporate in time most likely. But, you know, it's interesting that it's there. It's interesting that they found it. You start asking yourself, well, should I look at bookings across all the other leagues? Who knows? Maybe there's some systematic bias that still exists in the other leagues, these kind of things. So it can always provide me with learning information. So, yeah, so any tips that I subscribe to, I hope to learn at least something from it if I do. Can you do it? Now, you may think the following tips is easy, but it's not. It's mind-numbingly boring. It requires sort of a level of bureaucracy, accounting. It's quite stressful when the tips arrive, if you're not easily able to get the tips on. The money management that they provide won't necessarily be the best. It may be just not prudent enough. It may be too cautious. You'll have to go through downturns, regardless of whether you follow tipsters or do your own betting, and you'll have to do all of this without the satisfaction of saying that you were the one responsible for the success, and you'll have someone else who you'll be desperate to blame for the failure, and it will be their fault in your eyes because they're the ones providing the tips. So I would say do not assume that it's an easier road. And multiply all these things if you choose to follow a wide spread of tipsters in some effective, I suppose, tipster portfolio. This will just multiply. A lot of people think that by spreading out all the diversifying their portfolio, let's say, so, you know, no one can all go in one, you know, they can't all be on a downswing simultaneously. Well, you know, one of them can be small up, one of them can be break even, and two of them can be down significantly. They're not all down significantly, but you'll still be feeling the absolute pain and still having to enter those bets, track the records, track how much money you've made, track the money in the accounts, get the money out of the accounts when they're closed, you know, find new accounts. It's absolutely, I mean, you know, when people talk about being a professional gambler, for example, to me, the greatest advantage to any element of working for yourself, and it's only if you extract value from this, is working for yourself, whether it's being a professional gambler or, you know, website designer or basket weaver, it doesn't matter. The real pleasure is not having to answer to anyone else, if that's what really matters to you, because the rest of professional gambling, yes, there can be, if you're someone who comes up with your own odds and beating the market, that can be the most satisfying yet boring computer game in the world, often how financial trading gets referred to as. But it can also be just phenomenally boring, irritating, frustrating, wearing on the nerves. And, you know, if you're doing all of this with tipsters, and you might do this with your own job, you know, so you come home stressed from your job, but you've got 40 emails from tipsters that you've got to put all the bets on and then, you know, update the spreadsheet and all the rest of it. You know, it's just not, it's not pleasurable. And one thing I would say is, you know, some of this ARBing software records everything for you. You know, you click on the ARB and it takes you through to the website to place it. You know, click takes you through to the website via a VPN, a diverted IP VPN for you. You know, you can come home, you can log on for an hour before the Europa League kicks off, smash up all the ludicrous moves and ARBs that are there, and yeah, you may get a, you know, a closed account come Friday morning, but, you know, it took you half an hour to potentially make some money and get it all recorded for you, you know, stress-free. You know, following tipsters is just an incredibly stressful way to make money at times. You know, for me, it's almost, you know, one would be enough, and maybe in you know, an area where I don't normally bet, I almost would buy get a tipster that I thought would just break even just for my recreational bets. You know, let's say I like this, I don't know anything about Aussie rules, football, and I decide, you know what, I love watching it. Let's say my child wakes me up, if I had any children, wakes me up early in the morning at the weekend, and I want, you know, it's on Sky, so I find myself watching it with him or her while I'm sat on my sofa. I'd almost, you know, get a tipster maybe just because I want to have a bet, but I don't want to just hemorrhage money because it's just not in my nature if I can avoid it. But for those, you know, for breaking even, you can quite often find, you know, a free tipster, to be honest, as long as they're just sufficiently conscientious about, you know, watching the sport diligently enough and following the teams and so on. Quite often, if you've got access to a few different betting accounts, can get a decent enough price about it. You can break even on that without having to pay anyone. I think the overall assessment, my general attitude towards tipsters and tipster platforms is... I don't want to go into, you know, we can look at the tipster review sites. The honest ones will show you how hard it is to generally make money from betting, especially if you're not going to go down the route of easily exploitable mathematical errors on the bookmaker's website or their bonuses or arbitrage. If you need more proof, Joseph Bookdial's, you know, Twitter feed and website has ample examples of just how few people make money in the long term, or even beat the closing line long term. Christian Baer's now assessing some of the tipster review websites and showing, you know, how few of their tipsters are actually have any long term sustainable edge. So, if you know it's unlikely that I'm going to do much better than break even or lose a little, I'd rather do it off my own back and feel the joys of the highs of the wins to their full effect, and be responsible for my losses. But that's not to say that I don't see the appeal of following tipsters. And there are undoubtedly some tipsters who I think are providing achievable results in terms of if you could bet everything they suggest, you would make money. And I don't think it's necessary, you know, providing they're relatively open about the fact that, yes, you're going to need these three or four best odds guaranteed horse racing accounts. You're going to need access to, you know, these, you know, specific bookmakers because they're terrible at tennis, whatever it may be. And they say, look, you're going to get closed. But if you're happy to pay for this small amount of money for a lot of tips and then find ways to reopen different accounts, then, you know, absolutely happy days. And I think, you know, it is very possible to beat the recreational market. You know, I've worked with people and still work with people, you know, who have beaten the recreational market consistently over the years. Invariably odds compilers, former odds compilers, know where a lot of the weak spots are in the markets and can very easily pick apart some of them if they do their own odds compilation on the side for the purpose of betting into those markets. So, you know, it's undoubtedly possible if you're betting into that. Now, you know, how possible is it to make money, you know, from betting in general on some of the harder areas? Well, you know, Betfair does have premium charge payers, so they've certainly made money. And Pinnacle certainly does move its prices off the back of people it deems worthy moving the prices off. And you'd have to assume that those people are successful. So, you know, there's ample evidence in that sense of it being achievable to make money. But it is pretty hard. And it is a case of it's very hard to sort of break into the club in a weird way. It almost feels like at times there's only room for a certain amount of people to be making money which is actually makes more sense than it sounds in a weird way, because of course being a zero sum game, the recreational losers there needs to be plenty of recreational losers in order to pay for the occasional winners. So one area which would fall sort of in the tipster category, which I always have had a fondness for, is ratings, statistics websites, and prediction calculations. They're not selling you any tips at all. They're just providing you with statistics, possibly alternative statistics to the standard websites for that sport. And then occasionally they're turning those into a rating, and then they're going one step further, occasionally going from the rating to something that's a prediction for implied probabilities that could then be compared against odds, presumably, if you so wanted to. These websites always fascinate me, and some of them have most definitely over the years provided me with some of the most interesting next steps for me to learn how to maybe model a sport or evaluate the ability of a team, something like that. I first learned about Elo ratings off a website, then maybe Glitco 2 ratings off another website, expected goals, reading, like it goes on and on. And so I've always had a fondness for those kind of websites. I'd encourage people always to look into those, and soon you'll start to sift the good from the bad in those situations, who's coming up with something that sounds mathematically coherent and what sounds like rubbish. And particularly for statistics, I have paid for statistics over the years, particularly in a period when I knew nothing about web scraping myself, something like that. Someone else collecting all the stats for me was undoubtedly worth a lot of money to me in terms of time saved. So I do not lump those kind of websites in the same area as tipsters. Although the moment they start putting a prediction calculation and then stars next to them, or suggestions of home or away next to them, things like that, well, then they are they're providing a tip, and they instantly, become less interesting to me, because then they've deliberately looking to utilize it predominantly as a betting suggestion. And, if there's affiliate links around on the website, then that's maybe their primary source of income. And therefore its purpose of generating income rather than proposing, say, as an intellectual challenge. Like some of the early baseball sabermetrics, I should say, websites were giving out implied probabilities of baseball teams to win games or win their division, the World Series, that kind of thing. And they were doing it purely because it was an exercise in intellectual calculation. I'm sure some of the people who built that wanted to use it potentially for betting. And sure enough, lots of people who follow those websites would use them for betting. But they were doing those calculations, and often the best way to test a sort of calculation of that nature is against the betting market. But often they were doing that simply because they wanted to show, how predictive they could be of the future using statistical analysis. So anything like that is very enjoyable. So I remember for a long time it was the Deck Tech, which was the company behind Think Tank ratings, and was it Telegraph or the Times? Can't remember. So the Secret Betting Club, which is a group which tries to evaluate tipsters on your behalf, would compile tips basis the Deck Tech ratings. And eventually, I believe they went into partnership with them specifically for providing tips, and they were no longer publicly available, those potential ratings. But there was definitely a period where the Deck Tech ratings were, certainly, I would say, capable of beating the recreational market. Who knows? Maybe the current versions of it, can beat it now. I don't know. But, I'm always interested by those kind of things. I'm always happy to advise people to, look out for those. And I still, even now, routinely, at least once a month, will look at saved Google searches I have of things like, tennis forecast, tennis prediction, tennis computer model, tennis, you know, and I'll do it for several different sports just to see what new stuff crops up. And, you know, Twitter's another good one, example of this. You know, there's always people looking to evaluate. You can look at something like at Data Golf, which I've mentioned, you know, a couple of Canadian guys, I think. You know, they've started putting up their calculations of to win golf tournaments, you know, for free with no real, in, you know, huge assessment of, as a, you know, no idea of being a tipster or anything like that. They did, interestingly, test their model versus the betting market. So they knew that they wanted it to be used in that way, and it was a good way to test the quality of their predictions. And, you know, they went on to do partnership with ProtoWorld, I believe, you know, for DFS-type products. But in general, that was interesting because I could see people doing predictions without the sole purpose of creating a business that sells tips. It happened to be part of the testing, and it often is. You can read plenty of academic papers, and often the final attempt to prove a sports model is to test it against the betting markets as perceived way, and it's, you know, it's a good test. So those kind of websites I'm always fond of, and I'm not, you know, I don't sort of put those necessarily in the same tipster category. So just going back to Christian's questions, general attitude towards tipsters and tipster platforms, full of hope, but ultimately cynical, I suppose. Do you have an experience with tipsters, and would you advise investing in a tipster portfolio? Yes, as I said, I do have some experience with tipsters. Would I advise investing in a tipster portfolio? No, I can't say I would advise it unless you've thought it through very carefully. And I would add them one by one if you were going to do it. And I would do a lot of due diligence beyond just what the headline, what you could make is. There are people like Secret Betting Club and so on who will do some of the evaluation for you as to, you know, how attainable prices are and so on. But all these things are sort of slightly done by one person in a sort of glass cube. It'll, you know, the person who does the testing for Secret Betting Club, you know, what are they doing to disguise who they are? You know, what other bets are being used on the accounts they're testing with? There's various things. And they may well answer all these questions, but it's very hard to exactly replicate what you will then go and do yourself with your accounts. And so, you know, you can do as much due diligence as you like. Doesn't necessarily mean you succeed. And if you are going to invest in the tipster portfolio, I'm going to advise you to do something which I know that some people who use this for is do already, but I would say if you're likely to be a long-term flat better, if, you know, even while using tipsters, if, you know, you look at Joseph's work and Christian's work that says it's incredibly hard to make money, just put yourself in a position to be the benefiter of massive upside variance. And you'll say, well, what does that mean? I would say that make the assumption that the tipsters you're following are providing you with positive EV selections. And I would use small stakes, and I would combine those selections together. Wherever possible, I would be perming in multiples, because if you multiply positive EV, you get, you know, you multiply the EV. If you have multiple selections in bets and you perm them, you multiply out the positive EV. Now you'd say, well, I'm also, if they all happen to be crap, you know, I'm multiplying out the negative EV. Well, that's part and parcel of betting in general. I would say if you've gone very carefully to select tipsters who you think are at least break even or better, and you're perming them, and in small stakes, you're being conservative, you know, you're not spending money that you can't afford to lose, as they say, there's at least a chance that you can hit some massive payout, I would say, and hopefully have more fun doing it along the way. It can be utterly soul-destroying placing hundreds of Asian handicap bets, you know, win singles, and, you know, tossing up at the end of the day, you know, going through Flash Scores, whatever your favorite scoring website is, and, you know, you toss up and, you know, you've gone through 50 games and, you know, you're 5 units up and then 70 games and now you're 5 units down. And then crazily, time and time again, you get to the 98th bet and you'll break even. And, you know, the last two bets basically will dictate whether it was a worthwhile investment on the day or not. And, you know, if those two last bets are losers and, you know, you're down a couple of units in the day, it can just be utterly, utterly brutal. Whereas if I had a, you know, a soccer tipster, a horse racing tipster and a golf tipster or something like that, and I could just have an each way treble, I don't know, first goal scorer, Channel 4 televised, you know, horse in a decent race, and, you know, some golfer to win. You know, if I'd much rather place that each way treble for £5 and watch that, knowing that I've got the chance of a very large payout and can just capture that variance. I'm absolutely aware that plenty of people, you know, will dig me out for that suggestion. But, you know, if you're doing something that you think is overall break even, you know, you may as well put yourself in a position where you can potentially win the lottery or you can capture a lot of upside, is my opinion. So, and common pitfalls and what metrics to look out for prior to subscribing. I think I've described plenty of the pitfalls there and the metrics that you should look at. You know, to be honest, in much the same way that bookmakers who are looking to restrict accounts look less at, you know, what people have won, they look more about the kind of bets they place. And to be honest, your betting signature is all that really matters. Often the bet type, you know, if it lines up with bets that they've historically done poorly on, that can be enough. So conversely, if you're looking for a tipster, you want to look for, you know, the kind of tips that have historically been profitable types of tips. And they're normally the most unpleasant types of bets placed at the most unpleasant times, exploiting the most broken little each way terms, etc., that the bookmaker has. So, in a weird way, you know, you almost want to be looking for a bookmaker that looks like it's going to close you instantly. Sorry, a tipster who's going to close you instantly with their selections, because they're probably the ones that, you know, are going to be the winning ones. But yeah, that doesn't feel very helpful. Last little leg now, free versus pay for. Free, obviously, this huge amount of exposure for someone who's free. If they're good and they're popular, potentially sort of like your Racing Post tipsters or, you know, Hugh Taylor at the races, these kind of things, you know, if they're good at what they do, they're going to, the price is going to evaporate very fast. Even more important to get that target price based on their historical performance, you know, I would suggest that there are a few areas where a free tipster can be very good and successful and provide a sustainable, you know, output for their supporters. Golf seems to be an area where it's sort of possible, I think. But then again, the great thing about golf is if you think it's hard enough to have the discipline to follow a tipster, well, it's bloody hard having the discipline to bet big prices in golf. So combine the two, and you'll find plenty of people who won't stay the course following a tipster generally. So, yeah, it's possible. Although, you know, you've got to ask yourself, if you start seeing odds crashes when a free tipster releases their odds, you know, you've got to be very careful. It's unlikely that it's going to crash to a point where there is still value in the tip, I would say. And then the area that I will touch on just for the US market is professional gamblers being touts or tipsters. Everyone loves to say, why on earth, if you were successful at betting, would you not be betting the selections yourself and not doing a tip? Well, a variety of reasons, potentially. I actually know plenty of people, plenty is maybe an exaggeration, but I certainly know some people who are exceptional at pricing things up and betting fivers and tenners. For them, it's just not, they cannot feel comfortable with betting any significant amount of money. They have jobs, they look at it just as a bit of entertainment, intellectual challenge. Their long-term lifetime ROIs are staggering. They're the people that bookmakers absolutely used to adore cheap marks. You know, the guys used to come in, have fivers and tenners each way on early morning horse racing prices, phone up, maybe have a chat with a trader. I'm really over-romanticizing this. This wasn't so extensive as people make out, especially traders. But there are people who, you know, thank you very much, sir. And you knew that you could basically slash the price in half of a few fivers and tenners each way. So there are people like that. And invariably, they're not the first ones to put themselves out as a tipster, but quite often they can be convinced by other people who are going to do the hard work for them to use their information to create a tipster, and they will make more money selling tips than betting those fivers and tenners. And those people also are often absolutely fraught with despair at the prospect of other people losing money off their tips as well, because if it wasn't bad enough them fretting about losing their own money, they're even worse about fretting losing other people's. So there's a hypothetical. Now you may say, well, they're not a professional gambler who's trying to sell tips. No, but they're someone who could be. Their information is professional level, let's call it. Alternatively, there can be areas that are just not deep enough market. If Rufus Peabody, for example, someone whose material I like, Massey and Peabody Ratings, his website, who bets extensively for himself on college football, NFL, basketball, all sorts of areas. His background was originally worked for a Las Vegas sports consultants, used to provide tissues, or not tissues, sorry. Someone told me off for using overly UK anglicized phrasing. Would provide, big starter odds for casinos. He made a lot of his money initially from doing prop bets and placing lots and lots of them. Couldn't get much money down, so had to place as many as they can. And there were big ROIs to be had because they could often be quite wrong, the odds. Rufus has now moved on to betting sides and totals in size, and no longer will do prop betting by his own admission outside of probably the Super Bowl, where there is more opportunity. So if someone said to me, how would you like to sign up to a service called Prop Master, owned by Rufus Peabody, where he just sends out effectively a true price for what something should be and bookmakers which have it. And it cost me $10 a month or something else completely small. Let's look at it like as the Netflix subscription of betting. I would have absolutely no problem with that. Now, if 10,000 people signed up for it, obviously at $10 a month, that makes Rufus a lot wealthier. And it's unlikely that 10,000 people are going to be able to get on the over-under total yards for a quarterback. But the theory is that if he, restricted it to 20 people, 50 people, and you had the target odds, so even if they, let's say he had an expected, yardage line for something, 50 yards, and the under over was currently at 70 yards. Well, if the first person who gets the tips back the under and it moves to 65 yards, then the second person can look and go, oh, there's still 15 yards to play with. It's not impossible for people. Basically, there are people, professional gamblers have areas of their knowledge which they wish they could get on, but they'll never be able to get on. They're lost to them. And if they want to provide something which provides some sort of true odds and tips, and if there's enough, they may produce something preferably that produces hundreds of tips a week in an area that they know they can't get on. So let's say the prop market completely explodes in America, if you have something that just pops up new props every few minutes as new bookmakers come up with odds, well, some people will get the price, some people won't. But there'll be enough of them to go round, and they can, you know, make people a few. You would have, it's all about what you charge for it. It's all about the amount of opportunities you give people and so on. But it would be a way for, you know, if Rufus is doing all the calculations in order to come up with his side and total odds, wouldn't it be nice to basically add another $1,000 a month on tipping, you know, tip subscriptions, and feel like he's providing you with the true odds? So it's pretty honest service, integrity. It's the same true odds that have been generated off something that he makes money from. Now, you may be thinking, well, you've just described a really unique little niche sort of example there. And even then, I'm not entirely convinced that, you know, the customer gets huge benefit from it. And it's like, it's true. I am sort of quite niche, but I guess I just know some professional gamblers who operate tipping sites, and they try to do it with as much integrity as possible. And they know for a lot of the time they're providing tips for people with access to recreational bookmakers that they no longer have. And they often will be targeting areas that it is reasonably easy to make money on if you have access to those bookmakers. And they themselves can't. So how can they monetize that knowledge? And I don't have a problem with that. Providing expectations are managed by the people who sign up to that. Now, in America, you know, when it comes to touts, you know, the cries of, if you were any good, you'd make the money yourself. You would, well, if it's the case of NFL sides, absolutely. If I was any good at NFL sides, I could get down in massive size and I wouldn't need to be on a subscription site. So they're true there. But the overall perception that there's no way that a professional gambler could provide a, you know, tipping service which has value and integrity, I don't think it's impossible, put it that way. But yes, I do think that it's unlikely that someone who is, you know, saying 1/6 of the last six, 80% win rate on NFL sides, you know, this is very obviously, I say that very obviously, this is the problem. There's a lot of people who are new to betting, possibly less cynical, in America, and I believe the American audience is right to be concerned about this, because there are a lot of people that will be taken in by some of this stuff. It's very easy for me to talk as someone who's worked in the industry for a long time as just, oh, you know, how could you be so foolish as to be caught by that? But it's very easy, you know, it's, you know, I could be, you know, someone could tell me things about, you know, I'm know nothing about cooking, for example, and someone could tell me that, oh, you boil this and put it on that and be sniggering away, and I would just do it. I wouldn't know differently because I know nothing about cooking. And it's the same with people who will be looking to have a bet. They've not won any money doing it. They really enjoy it. They want to win. And there's a nice flashy site telling them that if they just hand over their credit card details, they'll turn them into a fabulous winner. So, I understand completely the skepticism of the US and undoubtedly what really is hatred, I would say, of the tout market. But I think there is a difference between those people who are trying and believe they're offering a service with integrity and believe they offer value, and those people who are deliberately trying and failing potentially, and those people who are deliberately going out there to hoodwink and mislead the people who follow the tipsters. So there you go. That's incredibly long for a podcast. If you've made it this far, well done. And hopefully I'll be able to come back for episode 10 and take on another one of your questions. Thank you for listening.